Today is Tuesday, the 31st of January, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Coming up, the acting U.S. Attorney General defied President Donald Trump. She was fired. Also ahead, the first week or so of the Trump administration has been a whirlwind of activity, much of it very controversial.
I think we're going to see unconventional activities like tweets and things like that, and I think that's just something that we're all going to have to get used to.
VOA National Correspondent Jim Malone is here to talk about it. Then we have more on the terrorist attack on a Canadian mosque. It's all on today's International Edition. In an extraordinary public showdown, President Trump fired the acting Attorney General of the United States after she publicly questioned the constitutionality of his refugee and immigration ban and refused to defend it in court. The clash Monday night between Trump and Sally Yates, a career prosecutor and a Democratic appointee, laid bare the growing discord and dissent surrounding an executive order that halted the entire U.S. refugee program and banned all entries from seven Muslim-majority nations for 90 days. The firing, in a written statement released just hours after Yates went public with her concerns, also served as a warning to other administration officials that Trump is prepared to terminate those who refuse to carry out his orders. We welcome to International Edition Judge Alberto Gonzalez. Judge Gonzalez is the former U.S. Attorney General and the former counsel to President George W. Bush. He's currently the dean at Belmont University College of Law in Nashville, Tennessee, and he's the author of a new book called True Faith and Allegiance. Joining me is VOA National Correspondent Jim Malone. Judge Gonzalez, thanks for being with us. What's been your reaction so far to the president so quickly firing the acting attorney general?
Well, the whole thing's been somewhat surprising, and there are certain events or missing facts here that I don't understand how we got to this point, because there is a standard practice in terms of review of an executive order by the Department of Justice and the approval by the Department of Justice of executive orders before the president even signs it. So on an executive order, typically, you know, I can't say the attorney general or the deputy attorney general is aware of every executive order issued by the president, but on one that is as high profile and as controversial as this, I find it surprising that Ms. Yates was unaware of the executive order before it was signed, and that the department signed off on it without her in any way being involved. So that is somewhat surprising to me. That should have happened before the order was actually signed by the president.
But we don't know whether it was or not, correct?
Well, I'm not sure. That's right. But let's assume that it was, and that she communicated her concerns to the White House before the order was signed. That would present a whole set of facts that would be much more troubling to me. Now, let's just assume that that she wasn't aware of it. It was only after the fact. So now she could, that she now is aware of the executive order. I would like to think that she had an opportunity and did, in fact, take advantage of the opportunity to express her concerns directly, either to the counsel of the president and or the chief of staff, and certainly to the president of the United States. Maybe that happened here. I don't know. But it is one of the reasons why I believe, contrary to the view of some others, that having an attorney general who has a relationship with the president of the United States is actually a good thing. It's not a bad thing, because if you have that relationship and the president of the United States trusts you and you deliver news that he does not like, he's much more likely to accept it and to move forward and change course of action. If he knows the attorney general and trusts the attorney general, it's much less likely that the president of the United States is going to ignore that advice. Now, I've said earlier that I was somewhat puzzled by the fact that this is you have an acting attorney general who's about to be probably removed from office once Jeff Sessions is confirmed. So her tenure at the department is is very, very limited in terms of time. And having communicated, I hope, to the White House that she has concerns about it, why she wouldn't resign as opposed to publicly sending out a directive to lawyers of the department and, in essence, to all the people of the United States that that the department is not going to defend this executive order. Again, I don't know what I don't know, and I certainly don't know Ms. Yates. Obviously, she has a sterling reputation, and I honor her service. But I wonder why she had to take the course of action that she did and why she just didn't simply resign. Because this is a complicated legal question, and there are many lawyers out there who have publicly stated that the president does have this authority, that the executive order is, in fact, lawful. Now, I can't speak to how it was rolled out. I think it's been botched. But the question as to whether the executive order is lawful, I think, is a complicated question. And there are those who believe that it was lawful. And I you know, again, I don't know what I don't know, and I don't want to be second-guessing Sally Yates, but I am wondering why she felt it necessary to send out that directive as opposed to simply resigning.
Your inference here is that you do not disagree with her firing. Is that correct?
No. Well, I wish it hadn't happened. It's never good for the department for that to happen. Look, she is not entitled to that position. She is not entitled to remain in that position. Her responsibility is to provide advice. She did that. I'm hoping that she simply didn't decide over the weekend, okay, I have a problem with this. I don't think it's lawful. And didn't tell the White House, and then simply sent out that directive. Her obligation is to determine what the law is, and then she should have informed the White House her views. I'm assuming that happened. I hope it happened. And then the White House may have said, no, we're not going to do that. We disagree. And at that point, she may have felt that she had no other choice than to send out this directive. But again, it's a complicated question. And the other option would have been to resign. And I think this really elevated things. And we're going to end up in probably the same place that we would have if she had resigned. But now it's become much more political. It may, in fact, affect the timing of the Jeff Sessions confirmation. I don't think it's going to jeopardize it, but it certainly may delay things a bit.
General Gonzalez, it's Jim Malone. I wanted to ask you about the ban as it's being put into place. You said it is a complicated legal issue. Do you see grounds there to be for folks to be constitutionally challenging it? And what do you see as potential legal weak areas for what the Trump administration is trying to implement?
Well, certainly with respect to those who have, like, say valid visas, those who have green cards, they're lawful permanent residents. I think the legality of it certainly is much easier to challenge as opposed to those who have no relationship, prior relationship to the United States, and come from countries where there are serious questions about the vetting and about the growth of terrorism in those countries. And I know there's been a lot of talk about, you know, how much vetting the United States does. The vetting that we do is quite extensive. There's no question about that. But that vetting is only as good as the information that we might be able to get from other countries. And from some of these countries, you know, the records that exist are not very good. They're not very reliable. They're not very thorough. And so if our very strong vetting is in large part based upon information which we really can't vouch for, you know, it really creates a strain, a challenge for us in terms of ensuring that we're not allowing people into this country who have evil intent. And I know that, you know, 99% probably of the people that have come into this country, these are refugees. They need help. We are a compassionate nation, a nation. We are a nation of immigrants. We have a long history of having open arms for refugees, and I would like to think that that can continue. But in order for it to continue, we do have to make sure that we have measures in place to protect ourselves. We'll never have 100% security. I understand that. But I think the American people support the notion of our government, our federal government, and view it as the number one obligation of our federal government to make sure that we are safe. And so I have no problem with, I think, the intent of the order. The way it was rolled out, I think, was terribly done. And the messaging has been all wrong. So there are many mistakes that have been made as to whether or not the order is, in fact, lawful. You know, my view is that there are arguments that can be made that it is. Other lawyers are making the arguments that it is lawful. You know, lawyers disagree, and I think that we have that instance in this particular case.
General Gonzalez, I can't let you get away without asking you about the Supreme Court nominee, who you think it might be, or any words of hope anyway.
Well, you know, I can say that of the three names most prominently mentioned, Pryor, Gorsuch, and Hardiman, Of course, I worked at the White House at Justice when all three were placed on the circuit court, so I know them all. Gorsuch actually worked for me as a deputy associate attorney general, so I know Neil very, very well, probably best of all three. I think they're all excellent. They all have sterling records on the Court of Appeals. And so, quite frankly, I think the country will be well served by the appointment of any of these three individuals.
Judge Alberto Gonzalez, former U.S. Attorney General, a former counsel to President George W. Bush, now the dean at Belmont University College of Law in Nashville, Tennessee, and the author of True Faith and Allegiance. You should go out and get it now. Is that good enough, Judge?
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for being with us. Appreciate it.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right, you take care. Jim Malone is still with us. What do you get from that? Anything new?
Yeah, he was fairly critical of the way this has been rolled out by the Trump administration. Democrats obviously have focused on that. We are getting more and more Republicans who are unnerved by some of the details of this and by how the decision was reached and who was informed about it. So you've got two stories here. The actual implementation of the ban causing these protests, not only here but around the world, and kind of a visceral reaction for people who think it says the wrong thing about the United States. And then the internal dynamics, how it was rolled out, and a number of even Republicans being very critical. I mean, he was talking about how it was done terribly, the way it was rolled out with
a bad
message.
That's the word he used, yeah.
Yeah, and he even said, you know, he didn't come down one way or the other whether he thinks it's actually constitutional. He says their lawyers will debate that. It's probably going to be sorted out in the courts. But here's someone who has a lot of experience in this area, being the former attorney general under President George W. Bush.
Overall, Jim, what do you think of the first week or so of the Trump administration? Obviously, it's been somewhat crazy full of chaos as we see it. And a lot of people are saying that's the way some people in the Trump administration want it.
I think anyone who was under the illusion that there was going to be a different Donald Trump coming into office from the candidate we saw during the primaries, I think their eyes are open now. I think we're seeing that he's very much intent on following through on what he said. You see this flurry of executive orders. Obviously, he's the focus on that. Those are limited in scope. Most presidents focus on what they can get through Congress in the first 100 days. He's focused on what his personal actions will mean from the White House. And again, this travel ban and restrictions, what he's trying to implement, was really at the heart of his concerns about immigration, and that drew a lot of support during the campaign.
Jim Malone, VOA's national correspondent, thanks so much for being with us once again. I will call on you as often as I would like, which means on a daily basis.
Anytime.
Thank you. This is VOA. Among the top stories in the world, hours after U.S. President Donald Trump fired Acting Attorney General Sally Yates for refusing to back his executive order restricting immigration, her newly installed replacement ordered the Department of Justice to defend the lawful orders of our president. The U.N. Security Council is to hold urgent talks today in response to a ballistic missile test carried out by Iran. The leader of the European Union put longtime ally, the United States, in a threat category today, insisting that President Trump is contributing to the highly unpredictable outlook for the bloc. And the European Union Tuesday condemned recent clashes in eastern Ukraine between pro-Russian rebels and government forces, calling the fighting a blatant violation of the Minsk truce. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on the VOAnews.com website and our VOA mobile app. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Some people think that the universe is just a hodgepodge of various celestial objects, such as planets, stars, and galaxies. But over the years, scientists have found evidence that the universe may be anything but random, that galaxies are connected to one another with streams of hot, thin ionized gas called the Intergalactic Medium, or IGM. The W.M. Keck Observatory in Hawaii says in a press release that they have received a new device they call the world's most sensitive instrument for measuring these filaments of the IGM. called the Keck Cosmic Web Imager, this device is designed to help scientists study the cosmic web in extraordinary detail, learn more about the life cycle of galaxies, and investigate some of the mysteries of the universe. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
We continue on International Edition from the Voice of America. I'm Ira Melman, joined now by Doug Bernard as we talk about social media. I guess I can guess what's hot on this on this day.
I bet you can. Look, obviously, this is a day, and it's been a week of I think, significant news, major news events changing. One that happened last night and one that's going to happen tonight. Of course, last night, the firing of the acting attorney general by the president, by President Trump. And of course, tonight at 8 o'clock Eastern time, President Trump will announce his nominee to be to sit on the Supreme Court as an associate justice. So two big hashtags trending in the United States and elsewhere around the world. You know, one is hashtag travel ban. And perhaps this should not be a surprise, but it's not just people in the United States that are talking about and using this hashtag. There are people all over the world that are paying very close attention to what it may mean for them, trying to learn more about it. Here's just a few comments. These are here's three comments in a row, people supportive of this. Let's see. Scott Ernest, he writes, tomorrow when I go to San Francisco Airport to support Trump and the travel ban, I will convert liberals to the righteous path of America. Josh Grimillion, why are people in such shock about this travel ban? Trump is staying true to his promise of putting America first, simple as that. Gina Gentry Loudon, she writes, I knew to boycott Starbucks, which was one we talked about yesterday, when the CEO got radical on guns, abortion. Now he's wrong on travel ban, just not my cup of coffee. Of course, not everybody is happy and pleased. Here's Nicola Malcolm. Nicola lives in Italy, and Nicola writes, inventions from countries included in the travel hashtag travel ban, quote, algebra, the written language, university, music, coffee, hospitals. So that's the other, that's one. And then, of course, another one that's trending right now, more in the United States, is hashtag SCOTUS. SCOTUS being an acronym for Supreme Court of the United States. And lots of people chattering there about who they think it might be. We heard some comments and lots of advice for what Democrats should do. Here's Margo Jones. Senator Dick Durbin just said the Democrats wouldn't rule out filibustering to block Trump's nominees. Woo-hoo. And finally, Jason Kander, with just 1,373 days until Americans vote in 2020, the responsible thing to do is to wait to consider any SCOTUS nominee. So we'll see how that all, I imagine neither of these stories are going to be going away anytime soon. So we're going to keep seeing them reflected in social media.
Doug Bernard with us as invited and really appreciated here on VOA with a look at social media. This is International Edition. Let's move on now. Clark Bedford is an artist who prides himself on always being a nonconformist. He creates collages, sculptures, photos to express his humorous outlook on life. He turned everything around him, even his house and his cars, into a fantastical art gallery. Faiza Al-Masri takes us on a tour inside Bedford's world, and Faith Lapidus narrates.
Clark Bedford's studio is filled with all kinds of materials collected from antique stores, thrift shops, junkyards, that he's turning into art. Each piece speaks for itself and reflects how Bedford was feeling and thinking at the time.
It's making a whole thing that has a whole feeling out of individual parts and allowing the individual parts to still show their individuality and their histories and their feel and all that. So you get the overall, and then you can start to look through it and see the things. So I think that's a modernist notion.
Creating assemblages is what Bedford is focusing on right now. In years past, he showed interest in sculpture and photography. A sense of humor has always been part of what he creates. Bedford started to express himself through art when he was a little boy. He says working for over 30 years as a conservator at the Smithsonian's Hirshhorn Museum and Sculpture Garden influenced his approach to art.
I think the best thing that that job did for me was, in a way, is make you slow down and not think about yourself, but think about art in a really broad way, other people's art. in conservation, you might spend months and months working on something that you're not even particularly interested in, but you come to see what's interesting about it. So I think that's the biggest influence, is you think more broadly about art, not about yourself and your own taste.
It's not just the interior of his house in Hyattsville, Maryland, that's been turned into a gallery. The exterior of the house is also covered with his creations. That gives him a sense of satisfaction and comfort.
I feel kind of like, well, I'm living in this like little world, you know. And so when I go out into the world and you're in traffic for 2 hours, whatever, you come home to this and it's kind of, you know.
But his little world goes with him into traffic, since his metal sculptures blanket every square millimeter of his four cars. There are wheels, whirligigs, spires, and colored stones.
Like you ride around in, and it's like your decorated horse. No different, really, than someone who dresses up in clothes, even like in fashion, and sort of puts on a bit of a show, you know, probably mostly to make themselves feel good. I don't understand why more people don't do this.
Wherever he goes, his car grabs attention and often admiration.
It's like being a street musician. You know, it's something which doesn't impose on them, but on the other hand, it's a little unusual. I think people like that.
Neighbor Peter O'Day says Bedford's house and cars make the whole neighborhood recognizable.
People stop all the time and then stop in the middle of the road and take pictures all the time. And, you know, it's curious. It's quite curious. Every time I look at his stuff, I see something I hadn't seen before. And when I have guys come over, you know, to do work or whatever, they're always saying, wow, what is that? And, you know, and people either hate it or they love it. And so that's how I know it's art.
Whether people love it or not, artist Clark Bedford says he's happy with what he's doing. He enjoys living in his own little world. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
We wrap up on that positive note. This is International Edition. Find us at voanews.com, like us on Facebook, VOA Now, and follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Thanks for being with us. Our thanks to director Patrice Martin, our engineer Thomas Blondet. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Enjoy your day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's been nearly 22 years since the signing of the Dayton Agreement ended the Bosnian conflict. But to this day, ultranationalists within the multi-ethnic country of Bosnia and Herzegovina are attempting to sow hatred, spark strife among neighbors, fracture the country along ethnic lines, and push agendas that prioritize their ethnic group at the expense of stability and prosperity for the country as a whole. As stipulated by the Dayton Agreement, Bosnia and Herzegovina is a single sovereign state comprised of two entities, the Federation of Bosnia and Herzegovina and Republika Srpska. The Dayton Agreement also established the office of the High Representative to ensure the implementation of the agreement. In 1997, the international community granted the High Representative special legal authorities, also known as the Bonn powers, to assure that Bosnia and Herzegovina's political entities comply with and fully implement the peace agreement. In September 2016, President of Republika Srpska Milorad Dodik held a referendum to designate January 9th as Republika Srpska Day. And on January 9th, Dodik led the celebration of Republika Srpska Day. Both the referendum and the holiday itself had been banned by the country's constitutional court, which found the holiday discriminatory against non-Serbs living in Republika Srpska. For his role in defying the constitutional court of Bosnia and Herzegovina in violation of the rule of law, thereby actively obstructing the Dayton Accords, and for conduct that poses a significant risk of actively obstructing the peace agreement, the United States Treasury Department has sanctioned Milorad Dodik. This means that any property or interest in property Mr. Dodik has within United States jurisdiction is blocked, and U.S. persons may not engage in transactions with him. the United States strongly opposes challenges to the Dayton Agreement and rhetoric that advocates secession for the Republika Srpska.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.